Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Navya Adhikarla joins us to discuss about psychological safety in the workplace, differences in her autistic experiences in India compared to the United States, and frustrating aspects of the job search process. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Navya, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Thank you so much, Doug, for having me.
I wanted to start off our conversation by learning about your story. Where does your story in the autistic community begin?
It's a long story. So I moved to the US in 2022 to do my master's at Duke University. But the real reason I moved here is because I really wanted to know who I was, what my problem, in air quotations, was. I wanted some answers. I really, really needed some answers that I was seeking from a long, long, long time. And I wanted to truly discover myself. So that's the main reason I moved to the US. And I've always felt different. I've always felt out of place, irrespective of where I was or who I was with or where I was in life. But I think I learned to accept it eventually. But I still needed to know what was going on. Or I really needed to somebody to pinpoint or like help me figure this out. And so I would go about asking questions that probably no one would ask or would want to know the answer of. But I often did not get any satisfactory answers and or satisfactory feedback about myself. And then I think I got lucky when I was having this conversation online with a complete stranger who said, you know what, I think you're autistic because you talk like me and I am autistic. And at that time, I did not know what it meant. I did not know what neurodivergent meant. I did not know what autism meant. But I had that idea at the back of my head because finally somebody's relating to me. And so a few months later, I was in this process of moving to another country, but I also did my own research and so many things made sense during that research for me. And then I needed external validation. And so I got a diagnosis and then I guess that's the technical point. But I would say the whole autistic story began many several years ago. Probably the first time that I felt like an alien. But this whole 4 to 6 months of research and the time and effort and the commitment I took to like really get down to the bottom of this, identity crisis, because I needed vocabulary, I needed words that I can use for myself. I had to just understand myself better. Not necessarily for the world, but for myself. And once I did that, I think I found myself in a better place, which is the autistic community and the neurodivergent community.
I love to learn about autistic experiences. And one aspect of our experience is culture. You mentioned moving to the United States. You're from India. In what ways does your autistic experience maybe differ between being in India versus the United States?
Simply and shortly put, there is relatively more tolerance, acceptance, curiosity, and education, plus really strict legal obligations that are supportive of the neurodivergent, community in the US. But in India, I feel there is so much gap in education and awareness itself. And in that context, I say the West in general is way ahead. That said, no system is perfect and there's always room for education. But to give you a number based on my personal experiences in both these countries, I would say I feel like myself in 4 out of 10 situations in the US. But in India or back home, it would be probably 0 to 1, out of 10 situations. There's no authenticity. And I feel like I'm just under this pressure all the time and nobody relates to me or I do not have enough support. That's how it feels like. I would also like to address my privilege. And I feel really grateful to have the Duke tag and the engineer tag, because those tags do matter to people who interact with me, and they also matter to me because there's this set culture of respect and learning and curiosity when I'm interacting with groups who know or who are aware of this tag, right? So I have this extra additional agency to educate them or to clarify and to like be myself and come out as myself. Back in India, I understand that these tags do not matter when I'm outside these communities, or I also understand from social media these days that there are initiatives to support and educate neurodivergent individuals in India, which I think is amazing. Funny, because it was just yesterday, I think India passed a law for digital inclusion, and they set up, the law states a few rules for, that are very much identical to, web accessibility guidelines. And I was like super amazed by it. Yeah, there are initiatives that are coming up. There are people who are now speaking up, or who are trying to educate people the right way. But all of these are pretty recent and not more than a decade old, I would say. There's also no legal obligation or law like the ADA, which is pretty old in the US, I understand. And there's nothing called accommodations. I've never heard of accommodations in my life, but I wish I had those when I was in school and in college. And there's no reporting that happens. Say, when you fill a job application here in the US or any sort of application, there's this question of, disability, or there's this disclosure section. But I've not seen that in my country or where I come from. And the disability rights back home, I would say, are non-existent to someone like me, because I have never been told about them. I've never heard about them. And I did a little bit of research and I dug up some of Indian laws related to disability. And there's so much vagueness and briefness in the definitions. And yeah, I really needed to search them instead of somebody just telling me that there's this kind of support. The major difference, I think, is in the degree of intolerance and in the degree of stigma. The degree is greater where I come from, which is why I had to leave in the first place. But not saying the degree here is zero, it's just comparatively lesser. So I get to take a breather now and then. So I get a break, this tiny bubble. There are bubbles here and there where I can just be myself and talk to people like me. I think it's really hard to access those communities in India. And people are now trying really hard to increase that accessibility, I feel.
Now, you mentioned Duke University, and you recently earned your master's in engineering management from Duke. What do you hope to focus on moving forward with this degree?
My idea with doing master's initially was to get into a B school, because I knew very well that I am a leader and I really wanted to hone those skills and learn more about myself, what my leadership style was and how I can, make an impact, or why my leadership matters, for that matter. So the engineering management program was a good fit, and I say that it came at the right time to me. So it's a condensed form of MBA, and it only takes a year and a half. And it's tailored for people who are engineers or who want to get into tech or who have been in tech for a little while. So there was that kind of context for me, and that was just really appealing. You know, I think everybody would relate to this. Everybody who's artistic is like, there's so much more comfort in having some sort of context and having some sort of like, oh, I know this. I think I can, you know, leverage this in understanding that subject. So that was one appeal. And the whole program would just like give me the basics of business and like enough room to experiment. So there's flexibility and there was context, and it came at the right time. So that's why I picked it up. So one thing that I think I really stand for, when you compare me, you know, with my cohort or with my other peers who took up the same program, is vividness. My profile is so weirdly vivid because I took up several things. It's like I tasted so many things on this platter, but I only took up things that I really wanted to do, that really interested me, and I've been mindful that way. I took up product design because I am creative. I'm a very design-oriented person naturally, which is why I complain so much about systems designed in the wrong way, or like system, you know, yeah, exclusion in system design. And so I'm a design person naturally. I'm a creative person. So that's why I took up product design. And like, it was super fun to learn all those. And then I also took up consulting projects because I love doing research and getting back with like coming back with ideas or recommendations. And I also love doing things in like projects, you know, time box projects. I was also interested in a tech ethics research project, and I only seized that opportunity. I realized I would not get it, you know, anytime else in life without a background in policy or without a background in law. And it was the best decision I took. I believe I am someone who is ethically, you know, gifted in ethical thinking. And it was very interesting to me to think about the philosophy of emerging tech like AI or Gen AI or synthetic bio. And I absolutely loved it. It was interdisciplinary, and there were so many different languages that my team was speaking because they come from different backgrounds, you know, literature, economics, engineering. And it was a happening space, and the research element, the learning, and the actual impact that our research made, you know, it was all so exciting. And our findings are with the OECD now, who are building on what we have done. And I'm just super proud of it. I'm just really happy that I took that up. And speaking of impact and circling back to why I wanted to do, you know, a master's related to business in the first place is leadership. And so I took up several leadership roles, both as a student and as a student worker. I coached my own peers. I coached teams. I coordinated projects for different departments within the university. I spoke about neuroinclusion and how, you know, my university can be a better place for neurodivergent individuals. And I still do that every chance I get. I love strategizing. So that's what I do when I speak. And I also took lead in creating accessible materials for a leadership class that I was TAing for. And I still am connected to my university, even though I graduated. And I'm constantly trying to influence that space, that education space, and advocating for accessibility and creating belonging for all kinds of people is what it just drives me. I explained all this just to say that this is what I want to continue doing. This is what I want to carry forward in life. I want to continue creating impact. I want to continue caring for people, caring for ethics, caring for ethical decision making, and caring for all the communities that I'm part of. I definitely want to continue design, perhaps through strategy, consulting, projects, or interdisciplinary, initiatives, or whatever role I take up, I just want to continue being a leader irrespective of my role or position. And this EM degree gave me a taste of several things, and I just choose to come back to that platter every day.
You're currently looking for employment, and I saw not too long ago that you recently wrote that on social media, as an autistic, ADHD, 25-year-old Indian woman navigating the job search process has been dreadful here in the United States. What have been some of the most frustrating aspects for you regarding this process?
One of the most important and frustrating aspects, and I think I'm being completely vulnerable here, is I am scared. I am scared for my career. I'm scared for my life, because I want to be in a workplace that will cherish me and love me for who I am. And that is very hard to find for anyone with identities that are not like me. And so I also know that nothing or no place is perfect. And I feel like I need a manual, for how to navigate when something bad happens, or how to navigate when something comes up, or how do I create, bridges between where I am now and where I want to go, and how do I do that in the right way, without burning myself out. And so it's just so hard to figure out everything out without a manual. And when my heart is set on, this is the kind of work I want to do, or this is the workplace that I want to be in, it's so much more harder to find those kinds of people or those kinds of places. And for me, finding a job is like trying to learn a new, foreign language and culture in a very short time, and then trying to prove that I fit in and that I'm a native, speaker or something, and which is just impossible, or it's just so, so hard to do that in such a short time. And it's hard in itself for anyone, I feel. I don't have friends or circles or a network that I can fall back onto, or seek advice or learn from their experiences, because that's how it has always been. I've not had friends since childhood. That's how it has always been. I think since kindergarten, I would have these 3 to 6 month friendships that would just end for no reason, and I will never be able to know why. I still now feel there's an invisible barrier between me and people who are not like me. There's so much misjudgment, there's disrespect, and for which I have no time, I really have no energy or time to spend on educating everyone I meet. It's just very, very hard for me to do that. And also feel, psychologically safe to say, hey, this is who I am, or this is my value, and this is what I'm seeking. It's just hard to do both. And there's also a huge disadvantage to not having friends, because, there's no peer review of, your process or your documents, and you don't know what's happening because there's no inside, information or bonus information. There's no market data, you don't know what everybody else is doing, and there's no moral support. And, if you have a tiny question when filling an application, there's no one I can text and ask, hey, this is a question I found, what do you select, this. So I just have to figure everything out on my own, while also trying to, make my own social manual, and also trying to heal trauma from my previous professional experiences, which is a huge deal. And this lack of feedback in this process, you don't know why people are rejecting you. Then, speaking of rejection, there's rejection sensitivity, both from, machines and humans, rejections to your applications, and also rejections to your networking, endeavors. The stigma, misunderstanding that I really don't have time for, even though I wish to educate, And there are personal challenges in this mix, like transportation, money, and the network and connections that come with being a normal, in double quotes, person. And there's also a lack of role models or limited knowledge of role models. You know, I want to know that someone like me has made it, or someone like me has been here or been around and has done amazing things. And I want to be able to access those people easily. And so there's no that kind of support network too. And of course, there are social expectations, like I have to have a job to prove I'm worthy. I need to have a certain salary or a package, which I think are also more of cultural expectations. And so this whole job hunt process feels like I'm compromising between two things, you know, strategizing for survival versus finding what I really want to do. And most importantly, to just like put everything in a short phrase would be, I need more time and more space. And no one will give me that. No one can give me that accommodation, because that is how the world works. I can't have extra space or time, because the industry moves forward every second of every day and it will not wait for me. And I just feel no matter how hard I try, I will never keep up with it.
Just feeling safe for me as an autistic person is difficult to come by. And that safety or psychological safety certainly pertains to the workplace. What are some ways that you think that businesses and managers can go about to better foster that safety for you?
This is going to be a long one. I'm a huge advocate for, you know, effective leadership and psychological safety. And so there are two things that I'm borrowing from my coach, which are also prerequisites to anything that I'm going to say after those two things, you know. The first one is, superior leadership and management see and change what is possible. That's what true leadership is. They see what is possible. They're not stuck, you know, in the current state of affairs, be it in any aspect, in people management or in tech management or whatever it may be. And the second part is respect. There's so much vagueness around this word. And there are three things that are evidence of respect. One is curiosity. Second is being open-minded. And the third one is, are you giving your best effort? If you're curious, if you're open-minded, and you're giving your best effort, those are the evidence that you are respecting that individual, that team, that committee or community, whatever it may be. These two are completely understood and owned, you know, by a leader, by a manager, by an individual or an organization. That is only when you can think about, what can I do to foster, you know, psychological safety? Because if neither of these, you know, are understood, or if they're misunderstood and there's gap, there's going to be more vagueness around words, and people will just end up, you know, in square one. And so the other interesting thing is, when you have these two in place, when you completely, your leadership completely understands these two things and owns it, that's when trust follows. Trust is so important, but it's not easy. It's really hard to build, especially when you're in a professional setting or you have a professional relationship. It's not easy to trust anyone. And I mean, I really don't have to explain that. But it follows once you know what superior leadership means, once you can see what is possible, and once you have the evidence of respect, you know, you are questioning your own assumptions. You are really giving your best, you know, when you ask yourself, is this really the best I can give to my team? Or am I just lying to myself and saying that this is, you know, this is, I'm doing my best, you know. Just be really honest with yourself and being open to learning about many things that we don't know yet. And this next list of, you know, things that managers can do or leaders can do, for, you know, fostering psychological safety, I think the first thing I would say is educating yourself, using the right, you know, ethical resources, ethical learning resources, and most importantly, your own team members. They are the best experts in this topic. You really don't need to go outside and like do something high and beyond, you know. Just listen to them, just talk to them. They are your best resources. And setting expectations. I'm also a huge, huge nerd of team charters, you know, and where you say, hey, this is my communication style. This is my individual goal for this, you know, quarter or this year. And, you know, this is how I communicate. This is how I want to work. And so this discussion that comes up around about, hey, I'm flexible this way. Hey, I want this level of autonomy, or I need somebody to hold me accountable. Hey, please help me with this individual goal, you know. And so what happens is you're setting expectations. So there's a standard and everybody signs on that charter. So it's like an agreement saying, hey, these are our values. These are how we do things. These are our individual, you know, goals and individual personalities and styles of communication and working. And so when people come back to you, they have the right kind of feedback. They know who you are. They know how you work. And so the feedback that you get is also very relevant to where you want to be. Setting expectations is the best thing that you can do, because you realize the value of setting expectations when things start going down, you know, when, you know, crisis hits or just surprises, you know, come by, and you know that your team knows how to work together. And the third thing would be resources. Give away resources to your team. It could be accommodations, it could be mentorship, sponsorship programs, any sort of support, advocacy, or, you know, the software that they need or the kind of environment that they need is the best thing that you can do. And it's also like the duty of a manager to enable their team and, you know, remove obstacles and give resources, right? The next thing would be co-create and collaborate. Again, coming back to the first thing that I said, is educate your other team members, involve actual diversity in your decision making and design. There's nobody asking you, or like, you don't have the sole responsibility of doing everything. Co-create. There are so many stakeholders. There are so many champions within your own teams and your own organizations. It's just a matter of, you know, reaching out to them and asking them to be in the discussion. And it's also equally important to involve people who would, you know, benefit at the end of the day to be in this decision making and to be in this whole design, right? And assess, how do you know that you have created an inclusive environment, or how do you know that something you've done has an actual impact? You assess, you evaluate, you go and talk to people, not just in a quantitative way or where you're like collecting data to just like prove or evaluate, but you have personal relationships, you have that trust with your team members. And so you pick up feedback, pick up things they say, or you pick up how the environment changes. You have these one-on-one informal conversations with them and you realize how much, you know, your initiative has impacted them. That's what truly matters, because that is coming directly from a human being. So assessing what you're doing is very important. And also thinking about, how do you diversify your organization? It's not just for the internal employees, but your other stakeholders, maybe supply chain. Are you including, you know, low income or Black women, you know, owned suppliers in your supply chain? Are you including neurodivergent suppliers in your supply chain? Do you even know that these exist, or are you aware? Maybe it also could be in operations. It could be your clients or your end users or your customers. So it does not just, you know, apply to your internal organization or just your employers, but it applies to so many other things. Your supply chain, operations, it could be anything. And so there are so many points of innovation in that context. Superior leadership also listens to what is not being said. It's more of a skill that comes with more practice. And you really need to genuinely care, to listen to that what is not being said. I think the technical piece of advice for managers is know all the legal obligations or civil and human rights perspectives and your own organization's policies and actions, what have been set up to, say, address bullying or exclusion or microaggressions. And are your team members aware of these? Is your organization doing something that may be insensitive to certain communities? It does not have to be one sort of community. And so constantly being aware of these technical stuff and preparing to have honest, difficult conversations. I say difficult conversations because honest, authentic conversations are not easy. To just ask, hey, are you feeling included? It's not an easy question to ask or answer. So prepare yourself to have difficult conversations many, 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 many times and to come with the right kind of attitude and mindset. I think these are a few things that managers can do. And with respect to businesses, I would say, please take care of your hiring process. The hiring process is so, so old today, and it's not always inclusive. So please do take care of the hiring processes. That's the first thing that a business should do. And accommodations, there are so many different kinds of accommodations, but I don't see that happening everywhere, at least in my personal experience. And so to just evaluate, assess, and like innovate with your accommodations would mean a lot to your organization and to your employees. Putting in place training and resources, which includes both your internal experts and also external experts who come with the right, resources, with the proper resources, and mentorship programs and putting up mentorship, sponsorship programs in place, to just start that conversation and to just start that conversation around support. Listening to your employees, are you including, the lowest voices? Are you including all kinds of diversity in your decision making? Are you including everyone when you're deciding on a policy or on an action? Because that's how you evaluate your culture, right? You see your policies and practices, but you also see how you're including people in decision making. And that's how you can evaluate your own culture. And most importantly, last but not the least, economic empowerment. Economic empowerment is the way you say that I am including you because I am economically empowering you. Give me a job or give me money. You empower me economically to be financially independent and have that extra agency, right? And there are so many conversations going on around wage inequity in different, contexts of diversity. It could be women. It could be neurodivergent individuals. Economic empowerment is the way you show that you're actually inclusive.
One thing that I'm much more interested as the days and months go by is AI. As I think when used properly, it can be a tool that can be so helpful. So you recently attended the Ability Summit 2024 by Microsoft, whose mission was to discuss how AI can be used to improve digital accessibility. What did you learn from this experience?
The Microsoft Ability Summit was, I think, an amalgamation of two different conversations that were happening parallelly. One was how AI is helping accessibility, and the other conversation was educating people about disability and the various kinds of disabilities. First of all, I was surprised to know that there's a role called the Chief Accessibility Officer at Microsoft. And I was also surprised to learn about this event. I wish I had known about it sooner. What I liked most is that there were so many different kinds of voices in the summit. I loved the representation. I loved how they tried to diversify the representation. For example, you know, there were conversations and interviews with deaf Black women. There was conversations around foreign policy in relation to disability and racial justice movement that overlaps with the neurodivergence movement, you know. And most importantly, wage inequity was also discussed, which I absolutely loved that they spoke up about it, even though it was just briefly. They also talked about physical accessibility and digital accessibility and the employment gap that disabled people face all over the world. And another interesting topic was accessible gaming, which I had never thought about, and it was so cool. An interesting aspect for me was AI for mental health. I think I liked the fact that they included mental health in their disability definition, but I was also intrigued, to say the least, about how AI is actually using data to, you know, in the mental health space, and how, you know, data is being collected, or you know, how Gen AI is being used for, you know, therapy support and things like that. There were like a lot of ethical questions from my personal perspective, but it was just very intriguing to see that that was actually happening, and that too in India. And I appreciated that all these events and all these conversations were like seeds. They start something and they show real people, they show real examples of how organizations are using, say, a particular AI product, you know, to increase accessibility. And all the real people who came to talk in the summit, they took pride in who they are, and they're not scared of advocacy. And that's just so energizing and like so positive to see. And one very special, I think, event that will, or very special conversations that I think I'll remember, is an interview with Sara Minkara. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. So she is the U.S. Special Advisor on International Disability Rights. And her interview was really, really amazing. And it's so eye-opening. And it's also somehow just, you know, warming to my heart to see how people in policy care so much about inclusion. She emphasized, you know, the importance of viewing accessibility as multidimensional. You know, it includes infrastructure, it includes technology, it includes communication, it includes culture, it includes AI, and also climate action and like global warming topics too. And it was just so interesting to hear from her, because she highlighted that there's a need for, you know, broader perspective on accessibility, financial accessibility, you know, climate-related accessibility. So it's not just limited to specific sectors, and there's so much more, you know, that we're missing in our definitions just because we're assuming something. And she also talked about co-creating, like I was saying before, the importance of, you know, disabled citizens engaging in policy shaping, which is so, so important. And so she encouraged this, you know, concept of co-creation and collaborating with actual disabled citizens when decision making takes place. There's something that she said, which I think was just so hard hitting for me: what spaces we are not in where we should be in, and what spaces disability has never been in, and why. Just asking these questions will make us realize what voices are missing, you know, at the table, and what sort of conversations we need to have, or what we need to do. Very interestingly, she ended the whole interview by saying that people need to have difficult conversations about inclusion and about sharing responsibility. And yeah, she just hit the right spots with me, and I felt so, you know, motivated and inspired that people in policy care so much about inclusion and they have such a broader view on words like accessibility and words like, you know, policy making. And it was just so amazing to just hear from more people like that. And there were also real, you know, examples of organizations like a museum in Switzerland who used AI to create accessible art for visually impaired people. And that is just amazing because the museum holds a million pieces of art and it's so well known. It's just so amazing that, you know, they thought about this idea and it makes people experience art in a way that they can. And there were several other examples and I just can't remember all of them, but it was a great event to just witness. And these examples demonstrated how AI can be applied in various domains, from healthcare, mental health, art, and not just limited to software or like productivity. And so, yeah, it was just amazing.
And lastly, how can our listeners learn about you? And for those that might be in positions to hire, reach out to you to join their team?
I will share my LinkedIn page and also my website. I'm always open to, you know, genuine connections, genuine curiosity. And so please do feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Well, Navya, thanks so much for joining me today. This is definitely a conversation that I'm going to remember. And it's always exciting to me when I get an opportunity to talk to younger people, because I'm in my mid-40s now, and especially those that are thoughtful and that are looking to make an impact in the neurodivergent space. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Doug. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm just so grateful to you that my voice is going to reach to so many people.
Thanks so much to Navya for the conversation. To learn more about Navya, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. We always love hearing from you and would especially love to hear from you relating to this episode on what actions can employers take that would leave you feeling more respected as an autistic employee. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts. Our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for our autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients and then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories. And if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it, so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.